The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud, where each week we choose some of our favourite articles from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Petra Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, The Spectator's editor, Michael Gove, interviews Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood in a wide-ranging interview touching on grooming gangs, AI, and the oath she swore in the Quran. The full interview can be found at spectator.co.uk/TV. Max Jeffrey accompanies the police in East London and looks at the search for the parents of three abandoned babies. Paul Wood asks if it's really the end of the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Susanna Jowett examines death at the Chelsea Flower Show. And finally, Leila Sanai reviews Graham Swift's new anthology of short stories, 12 Postwar Tales. Up first, Michael Gove.
Shabana Mahmood may be the only Labour politician to have persuaded Rishi Sunak to vote for her. The former Prime Minister was in the year above Mahmood when they both studied at Lincoln College, Oxford in the 1990s. When she ran for JCR president, Sunak pledged to support. Meeting Mahmood in her ministerial office this week, I can understand why. There's a sense of quiet purpose about her that instills confidence. I'm predisposed to sympathise with her more than most because she occupies the post that I held for 15 months, Lord Chancellor. It's the most glamorous and also the least attractive job in the cabinet. You're the only minister with your own personal gold-braided gown, wig, pumps and purse-bearer, or at least the only minister who has to be seen with all four publicly. But you're also in charge of prisons, the care of 90,000 souls, who are simultaneously the most broken and most dangerous in society, is your responsibility. Prisons have been in crisis for years. Few holders of the office in recent times have prospered politically. I was sacked from the role, and my two predecessors were demoted, as were most of my successors. So it takes resilience to survive in the role, let alone succeed. Does the incumbent have what it takes? When Wood, who is 44, an MP for Birmingham Ladywood, as well as a former barrister, has been in post for less than a year. Already, she has had to authorise a controversial early release scheme for prisoners and confront the judiciary over sentencing policy. But her battles have only started. Sitting in the ninth floor Westminster office I once occupied, she seems serene, but her analysis is stark.
In England and Wales, I'm looking at zero prison capacity in a few months' time. It's not acceptable to me. So the first principal point is we've got to get out of this permanent crisis. We've got to never be in a position where governments of all stripes have to do emergency releases of prisoners. And it falls to me to make sure we get that right. You know, I consider that my biggest duty in this job, actually, to stop this system from being permanently on the brink of collapse.
Facing the prospect of a prison estate in which there is literally no room for new inmates, she has to contemplate radical measures. A review of sentencing policy she commissioned from David Gawk, the former Tory Lord Chancellor, is due shortly. He will recommend earlier release for prisoners who undertake rehabilitation and exhibit good behaviour. Yet in Mahmood's view, the situation is so concerning that she will have to take radical action well before any of his recommendations can be enacted.
And this, I mean, it's an indictment of the situation we're in, because you can take a big decision like an early release step, as I had to do, and it still doesn't buy you enough time. You're still on the verge of running out.
Part of the answer, she says, will be an expansion of community sentences.
I think we've got to expand the range of punishment outside prison, because... you know, in a world where we are always running out of prison capacity, we do have to think about those offenders who can be effectively managed in the community.
Public confidence in community sentences is low, with offenders capable of absconding and probation services stretched. But Mahmood believes technology can ensure compliance in a way which reassures people.
The next generation of tech and AI in this space can, in a way, I believe, ultimately more effectively manage prisoners, because the eyes of the state can always be on you, checking your behaviour.
Liberals might shiver. However, Mahmood isn't concerned, and nor is she worried about the political cost.
It's not about me. I've got a job to do. And that's the only thing I'm focused on, is what I care about. And I take a solemn oath on my holy book. And to be honest, that is a very good leveler of helping you decide what is and what is not important. And I know what's important, and getting this right for the country is the most important thing.
There aren't many politicians today who seek to reassure you that they'll deliver by telling you about the oath that they've sworn in the Quran. But Mahmoud, who is the only Muslim in the cabinet, is refreshingly candid about her beliefs.
It is the absolute, as I say, core of my life. I was just going to say, if you look around my office, you'll see quite a lot of references to my faith. It is the thing that grounds me in my life. And it's where I draw my sense of duty and public service from. You know, my understanding of Islam, how I have practiced Islam my whole life, has been about viewing life as a gift from God, but it's also a test from God. The things I have been blessed with and privileged to have, like a great education, being British, being in this country, having the freedoms that I have, they're not just a happy thing for me to clock up for myself. It's a test. I have to earn it and prove I used it for good, and to show that I'm worthy of it. And that is what drives me in public service.
Prisons aren't the only crisis area you face. We have a huge court backlog.
We do. I think that, again, one of the horror discoveries when I came into office was even running the system with funding at total max system capacity, the backlog still goes up. And that's because the sheer demand coming into the system is huge.
So in order to tackle the backlog and ensure swift justice, she's ready to restrict the right to trial by jury. A huge shift in how British justice will be delivered.
We need big reform in our courts. The sort of territory you're looking at is a restriction of the sorts of cases that get a Crown Court full jury trial, maybe make more use of the Magistrates Court, but also, as the Times Justice Commission and others have looked at, the possibility of an intermediate court between the magistrates and the Crown Court that can hear more cases, which might be judge-only or judge-led in some way. There'll be different models, I'm sure, suggested to us. That is controversial because it means some cases that currently get heard in front of a jury won't in future. But, you know, I think we have to reinterrogate what justice really means. And if you're a victim today of, say, rape, and you're waiting 4 years to get to court, that's no kind of justice at all in my book. So we have to do something differently here.
Mahmoud's belief in championing the cause of victims also gives her a particular perspective on the grooming gang scandal.
There have been successful prosecutions of large numbers of these criminals, and many are currently in our prisons. So on one level, you could say, well, accountability is occurring because these criminals are facing the full force of the law. But I think the way that this scandal has played out asks a bigger question, which is you might be getting accountability and justice through the criminal justice system, but it doesn't feel like proper accountability and justice for all of the victims. And that's because there is this still, I think, outstanding question of why so many people maybe looked the other way, or why this wasn't picked up and given the prominence that it was, that it needed. And so I think that's where justice might technically have been delivered, but there's still a moment of reckoning to come, I think.
Mahmoud characterises that moment of reckoning as a need for truth and reconciliation.
There is such a visceral pain and a total shattering of trust in people that should have done a better job locally, whether that's local authorities, children's services, police officers, all the sorts of people you would feel you can trust. And that trust has been fundamentally shaken, if not totally broken, in some of these places. And I think there is that need for reckoning. I hope I'm not overstating it as truth and reconciliation, but in my mind, that's what it feels like.
Discussion of the grooming gangs scandal has inevitably been overlaid by questions of culture and community. As Britain's most high-profile Muslim politician, Mahmoud appreciates how questions of identity and integration have become more salient in our politics. At the last general election, she faced a challenge from a Gaza independent candidate, running on the platform that she and Labour had betrayed the Muslim community. Despite reportedly being unhappy with Keir Starmer's Gaza stance earlier on during the conflict, Mahmoud is critical of political parties tailoring their position to certain communities.
Look, I think on these sorts of issues, and in fact on all politics, you've got to start with the thing you believe and you've got to do the thing you think is the right thing to do and make an argument for that first and foremost. I think politics gets into trouble and the country gets into trouble when you start trying to tailor particular messages to different communities. I've always raged against that as an occasional recipient of such politics before I became an MP myself. I don't like that way of doing it. We have a principal position on the conflict in the Middle East and we've got to make an argument for that and why we think that's the right way forward. There will be people who disagree. And they are entitled to in this country. And, you know, that's the beauty of democracy. But you can only answer a politics you disagree with in the democratic system with more democracy and more chance of challenge and so on. The conversation within the Muslim community that I have is slightly different in that I think as a community, I always make the argument, and people can disagree with me, of course, and they do. But domestic concerns to me are just as, if not more important than geopolitical concerns. People are entitled to vote on whatever basis they want, but actually the bread and butter of how we live our lives in our own country, how we relate to our own fellow citizens, our economic prosperity in relation to that of our fellow citizens, those to me are the main issues of the day. And so when I'm having this kind of discussion with my constituents in my own patch, you know, my argument is more, by all means, be motivated by other things too, but you've got to care about here as well. And, you know, your life here matters first and foremost. And I don't want to see the community or large parts of the community self-segregate into, you know, what might be described as sectarian politics, because then I think your voice in the mainstream diminishes.
Mahmoud's belief that policy should be shaped in the national interest rather than reflecting any sectional concern also informs her approach to immigration, where she's uncompromisingly on the side of Keir Starmer's tougher line.
I look at a community that I represent, which is 70% non-white. And if you ask my constituents, they want a fair managed migration system. They think there should be rules. Most of them will say they came in on the basis of really quite strict rules that they followed to come to this country to work and make a life for themselves. And they want that sense of fairness for everybody that might come now or in the future. But they do want strong borders and they do want a system that, you know, everyone plays by the same rules. So I've always had that view around migration. I just don't know why we've got ourselves in a tangle talking about migration controls on the left of politics, because it's really pretty fundamental to the way a lot of our voters think.
Starmer's right turn on migration has been attributed to the socially conservative Blue Labour movement within the party.
I mean, well, I have a natural affinity for the faith flag and family element of Blue Labour. Again, if you take a look around my office, it probably says quite a lot of that to you too. So to the extent that, you know, Blue Labour is a group of people that call for a more communitarian politics, a recognition of our rights and responsibilities to each other, the politics they argue for is very rooted in the day-to-day concerns of working people across our country. If you were trying to put me in a box, you would say social small c conservative.
While Mahmoud may be a social small c conservative, she's Labour to her core, having been brought up in the party, and is respected as a formidable grassroots organiser. It is that secure immersion in the party's traditions, as well as her long experience of fighting street by street for Labour, that allows her to be her own woman. So, when I ask her who her political heroes or heroines are, it's no surprise that they are both notably strong women.
Well, I tend to go for the women that broke the mold and came through in tight patriarchal systems of Benazir Bhutto, Margaret Thatcher, not for the substance of their politics, but for what they represented for women and the ability to make a contribution.
Benazir and Maggie, both like Mahmoud, Oxford graduates, both known as Iron Ladies during their time. Mahmoud knows she will need her own steely resolution to survive the inevitable storms ahead.
That was Michael Gove. Next, Max Jeffrey.
Elsa had been alive less than an hour, and her umbilical cord was still attached when she was wrapped in a towel, put in a Boots shopping bag, and left on the Greenway, a cycle path built on a Victorian sewage pipe that runs through East London. She was abandoned on the 18th of January 2024 by a rose shrub on the coldest night of the year. She was not the first baby to be abandoned in that area of the Greenway near Plaistow. On the 17th of September 2017, a baby boy was discovered wrapped in a towel under a bush about a mile and a half from where Elsa was later found. The hospital called him Harry. Then, on the 31st of January 2019, someone found a newborn girl, also wrapped in a towel and inside a shopping bag. She was beside a park bench 500 yards from where Elsa would be left. It was cold that night too, and the woman who found her said frost had formed on her head. She was taken to hospital, where the staff named her Roman. All three babies are black, and DNA tests showed that Elsa, Roman, and Harry have the same parents. Last June, at the East London Family Court, Judge Carol Atkinson let the DNA findings be reported for the first time. While Roman and Harry have been adopted, Elsa cannot be until the police investigation to find her parents is concluded. Judge Atkinson has been pushing officers hard to track them down. In March, The Spectator contacted Detective Inspector Jamie Hum from the Metropolitan Police, who leads the investigation. Hum has worked in the Met for 19 years, three of them focusing on child investigations. He told me there was no CCTV footage of Elsa's abandonment, nor any witnesses. Detectives always work from hypotheses, and for a while Hum's was that Elsa's mum didn't want to be found. The evidence just pointed that way. Elsa and the other babies were left swaddled in public places, which seemed to indicate that whoever abandoned the children cared for them. The fact that they were found near to each other suggested the mother lived locally. But this theory changed earlier this year. In January, Crime Stoppers offered a £20,000 reward for information leading to the identification of the baby's parents. Police also appealed for help from doctors and pharmacists who may have seen the pregnant mother. Crime Stoppers got nothing. The police received only 4 calls. Instead of having a leading hypothesis that Mum will not come forward, Hum told his officers in a briefing afterwards, "My hypothesis now is that Mum, he always calls her Mum, cannot come forward. It is possible that she is being held captive in the area." Acting on this new hypothesis, police launched a manhunt last month after the National Crime Agency, or NCA, drew a GAI, or Geographical Area of Interest, looking at all the Greenway's possible entry and exit points and marking a group of 400 homes where they thought whoever left the babies probably lived. The main road in the GAI was Lonsdale Avenue, a 2-minute walk from where Elsa was found. "The answers are here," Hum Superior Detective Superintendent Lewis Basford told me. Hum and his team are carrying out door-to-door inquiries. If the occupants are black, police policy is to ask them to do a swab test to check their DNA against that of the babies. The occupants can of course refuse to be tested, although that in itself may be revealing. It's the job of Hum's colleague Detective Sergeant Lawrence Dight to ensure all 400 homes are visited by either the police or the NCA. When I joined the team as they made their inquiries, Dight had 4 addresses on his list that hadn't answered on previous visits. At each home, he knocked, stepped back, checked for any visible movement inside. "You're always double-guessing yourself," he told me, and then left if nobody came to the door. One of the 4 houses answered the knock, but only a decorator was in. A local man approached us. "What's this about, gentlemen?" he said. "Abandoned babies," said Hum. "You lived here long?" "Long enough to know about it," replied the man. "I'm from the police. We're still trying to find the baby's mum. I think she's long gone. You reckon?" "Yeah, it's like trying to search for Maddie McCann, isn't it?" The investigation felt like a similarly unlikely exercise, and Hum, in his way, admitted as much. Knocking on doors and hoping to conduct swab tests, he told me, are not efficient inquiries. Down Lonsdale Avenue, I came across a couple called Derek and Tess, who have lived in the neighbourhood for 42 years. I asked them how they thought someone in their community could hide 3 pregnancies. "If someone was 3 doors away, we wouldn't know their name," said Derek. "Many people in the area don't speak to each other," Derek and Tess said. "Not through a fear of discussing the babies," several residents hadn't even heard about them, "but just because this is how life is in some parts of the capital, some parts of Britain. We talk about communities, but actually they can be quite isolated," said Basford. "You get 3 or 4 houses and they're very alike and very akin, and then you'll find pockets where they'll not know who is next to them. The borough of Newham that the Greenway divides was once a favoured retreat of the gentry and wealthy merchants. The district of East Ham was studded with mansions. On the southern marshlands by the River Thames, villagers fattened cattle and reared horses. When the East End industrialised, the mansions were replaced with tenements. the marvellous growth and development is absolutely without parallel in the history of the United Kingdom, wrote one historian of the East End in 1908. Since then, many English families have moved out and many other nationalities have moved in. It is not a particularly social area. I asked Dyte how working in child investigations affected him. Seeing death and gore didn't linger, he said. Before joining the team in 2023, he was in the murder unit for 5 years. It was thinking about what a child had gone through that made the mind whir. How many times can you keep going back to that? He wondered. He's a father of two, and he said it wasn't surprising that officers didn't like to spend too much of their career on child investigations. The DNA results will take several weeks to come back. There will be many, but even then there might not be a match. When I spoke to Hum, he kept bringing up a case of child abandonment from 1998 in Cheshire. A baby boy's body was left in a bin bag near Gulliver's World theme park, and it took 25 years to find the mother. Perhaps, Hum was suggesting, the police in this case will be spending many years on the Greenway.
That was Max Jeffrey, and now Paul Wood.
All wars end one way or another. One of the longest wars in the Middle East, between Turkey and Kurdish separatists, may finally be over. After 40 years of bitter struggle, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, has declared that it will disarm and disband. It's an achievement of a sort for the PKK's imprisoned founder, Abdullah Öcalan. He might become a free man. It's a triumph for Turkey's leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He might become president for life. The Kurds have adjusted to a new reality in the region. From Ankara to Riyadh, the chess pieces are shifting and the board might end up looking very different. This might even be accomplished without blood being spilled. The PKK is designated as a terrorist group by Britain and many other Western nations. The announcement that it would give up its guns was made at its party congress this week. Middle-aged men and women stood in rows wearing dark green camouflage uniforms with the Kurds' traditional broad sash at the waist. They looked dejected, vaguely at attention but with shoulders slumped. They were acting in the knowledge that the PKK has suffered a military defeat, no longer able to mount an effective attack inside Turkey. There have been ceasefires and peace talks before, but this time the PKK is promising to transform into a purely political organisation. The question is whether they'll carry with them the fighters who remain in mountain camps in Iraq and bases in Syria. Will there be a real PKK? The PKK has been edging towards this decisive break for months, pushed along by its lost leader, Öcalan. To his followers, he's known as Apo, that's uncle in Kurdish. Uncle Abdullah's handsome face, with dark bushy eyebrows and a thick moustache, is everywhere the PKK is found, his portrait in homes and barracks and stuck in car windows, on patches sewn onto soldiers' uniforms, on flags that sometimes have no other symbol. He is the Wizard of Oz, his image, thoughts and views, his utopian ideology, dominating the organisation from the jail cell that's been his home for a quarter of a century. In February, he issued a statement saying, "There is no alternative to democracy." The Turkish media call Öcalan a baby killer. He likes to describe himself as the Kurdish Nelson Mandela, a leader who entered jail as a convicted terrorist but who turned to peaceful politics. Mandela returned the favour by saying, "I am part of the Kurdish struggle." He was arrested in Nairobi in 1999 by Turkish special forces, helped by the CIA, and was paraded in front of TV cameras looking dazed and confused. There were claims he'd been drugged and tortured. Then he was sent to Imrali Prison, on an island near the coast of Istanbul. The authorities removed all the other prisoners, and he was left in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day, guarded by more than 1,000 Turkish troops. As his lawyers put it, Imrali was a prison with one single cell for one single prisoner. It was isolation within isolation. Öcalan's rare critics inside the PKK have said he was broken by his incarceration. He did move steadily away from the things he once stood for, an independent Kurdish state and the armed struggle to achieve it. but this was part of a long ideological journey, far stranger than the one Mandela made. Öcalan was born in eastern Turkey around 75 years ago. There's no birth certificate. He's spoken of overwhelming unhappiness in his upbringing. His father was a peasant farmer, poor even by local standards, a weak man, mocked by the other villagers and publicly humiliated by Öcalan's mother for being unable to support the family. She was a fierce, angry woman, and when Öcalan ran home crying after being beaten by some older boys, she threw him out and told him to come back when he'd got his revenge. Öcalan has said he learned the uses of violence in childhood. I cracked the heads of many children. I became the attacker. This may be too obvious as a psychological explanation of how a shy boy grew up to become the leader of militant Kurdish nationalism in Turkey. But his upbringing certainly shaped his politics in other ways. Öcalan was upset when a younger sister, Hava, was lost to an arranged marriage, traded for a dowry that included a few sacks of wheat. He later called such marriages a kind of death for women, and PKK-run territory would become an oasis of female equality. He learned communist revolutionary politics as a student at Ankara University in the late 1960s. He dropped out, and a few years later founded the PKK at a meeting attended by only a couple of dozen activists. They would take on the might of the Turkish army and drench the country in blood. By the time of his arrest, however, Öcalan was moving away from Marxism-Leninism. During the long hours in his cell, he read every book written by an obscure American philosopher named Murray Bookchin, who lived in rural Vermont. Bookchin was in his 80s, by some accounts a grouchy old man who wore braces and had rows of pens in his top pocket. He'd spent a lifetime as an anarcho-syndicalist and radical ecologist, and he developed a theory of face-to-face democracy called libertarian municipalism. Öcalan adopted it. The Turkish state wouldn't matter if the Kurds could run their own lives through local assemblies, which he said should adopt green politics. He went into prison a Maoist guerrilla leader. He may emerge a Lib Dem councillor. But Öcalan has held these positions for years. Some accuse President Erdogan of reaching an understanding with him only now that he needs Kurdish votes to let him change the constitution and stay in office. Professor Christopher Phillips, who's written about the PKK's long war, told me there were many opportunities to make peace throughout Erdogan's time in government, but he always abandoned the effort. Dialogue with the PKK was driven by cynical domestic political calculations, he said. The biggest outcome of what he called the seismic Kurdish decision might be to keep Erdogan in power for another decade. All that may be true, but whatever Erdogan's motives, he's allowed the PKK an opening to end a conflict that's cost perhaps 100,000 lives. Turkey is also making peace with Syria, now that it's in Sunni Muslim hands. Donald Trump, meanwhile, is in the region negotiating a grand bargain involving Iran, the Houthis, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and even the Israelis. Like Erdogan, the leaders of all these countries would see any deal as a means to keep their grip on power. Everyone may be doing the right thing for the wrong reasons, but this is still a rare moment for optimism in the Middle East.
That was Paul Wood, and next, Susanna Jowett.
It's a matter of life and death at the Chelsea Flower Show this year. No murders are planned as far as we know, but there will be gravestones and even a coffin. This is to be a celebration of death. The Royal Horticultural Society's annual flower show will include funeral flowers in the Grand Pavilion for the first time since it moved to Chelsea in 1913. The display is being put together by the Farewell Flowers Directory and, I'm told, there will be no tightly wired whorls of white carnations spelling out, "Love you, Mum." Instead, passers-by will be left thinking of country churchyards, wild grasses and meadow flowers, species like campions, cornflowers and cow parsley. The display includes a willow casket filled with the kinds of flowers you'd see in British hedgerows, held up by upturned birch branches. Everything on the stand will decay naturally. No floral foam, no plastic or imported flowers taped into dishes and wired together. No microplastics to go into landfill. Looped along a twine rope will be tags printed with the words, "I'd like my funeral to be..." Many of those involved have had to answer that question for family members. Georgie Newbury, a flower farmer from Somerset, is one of those building the display. She lost her brother to brain cancer 15 years ago. "For his funeral, we all brought flowers from our own gardens," she says. "He is buried in a woodland glade outside Glasgow with flowers from our mother's garden, his own, mine, and his mother-in-law's planted above him." Georgie wants us to talk about death, not scurry past it. "My brother died in the same year as five of my friends. I was pregnant with my daughter, so I feel I didn't really deal with their deaths. When my friend's daughter died a couple of years ago, we gathered around my table, creating flower arrangements for her coffin, talking about her as we did so, listening to music that she loved, going over the memories that would then be polished into funeral speeches. That day was one of the greatest privileges of my life. Being involved helped me remember all those other people who I've loved and have died. That sense of storytelling is such a simple but powerful way to grieve." So much about funerals has become a production line, says Jill Hodgson, who started the Farewell Flowers Directory a year ago. Funerals are just part of the death admin, simply going along with traditions. Wearing black, buttoning up, getting it over and done with. She wants to change that. The company has brought together British florists who offer people planning funerals more than just catalogue flowers. Part of the reason for her focus on flowers is that Jill worries that we're losing a connection to death, a sense that it's natural and inevitable. Funeral directors are usually wonderful, sympathetic people, but too often they just want to shepherd a shell-shocked grieving person through the process as painlessly as possible. This can inadvertently take away from the element of choice, of remembering the uniqueness of the person at the heart of a funeral. We want to give that choice back, restore the feeling that death is natural, that it is a moment to pay homage to that life. So, are we finally losing our squeamishness about death, our need to cover it up with the anonymity of process? In a recent co-op survey, 68% of those polled thought that funerals should be a celebration of a person's life, with tears, music and laughter, not confined to gloom and solemnity. In a strange way, grief can be joyful. Many of us will recognise Georgie's story about the death of her friend's daughter. When done well, grief means talking about a person, what they meant to us, why we loved them. Others have noticed this desire for something more than Victorian stiffness. Poppy's Funerals in Tooting offers more colourful, sometimes bonkers send-offs. It has organised horses wearing gold unicorn horns, leopard skin hearses, a stuffed pet parrot, a mushroom-shaped coffin, and others made of cardboard, scrawled over with loving messages from those left behind. "It's not about the spectacular," says Poppy Mardell. "It's not about the spectacular," says Poppy Mardell, a trained art historian who left Christie's to bring art and meaning to the monochrome world of death. "It's about giving grieving families the opportunity to have a funeral that is meaningful to them. It's about having that conversation." Which is what the display at the Chelsea Flower Show is about too. We all eventually wilt and die. Death is inevitable. And sometimes it can also be joyful.
That was Susanna Jowett. And finally, Leila Sanai.
When Granter Magazine's list of Best of Young British Novelists first appeared in 1983, it was a cue for me to immerse myself in the work of the named writers. There was the dazzling, sardonic humour and knowing intelligence of Martin Amis, Ian McEwan's twisty psychological thrillers, the cool prose of Kazuo Ishiguro masking latent pain, and the fantastical rich threads of Salman Rushdie. Rose Tremaine's anthropological insights and Pat Barker's harrowing war stories were also transfixing. It took me a while to get to Graham Swift, but when I read Waterland, Mothering Sunday, and the Booker-winning Last Orders, I was quietly absorbed. Swift didn't aim for the pyrotechnics of his literary brothers. If they were strutting peacocks in the aviary of new writers, he was a sparrow. His writing was smaller, less gaudy, yet capable of inducing deep emotion and indelibly etched memories. So it is with his short stories. His style is the opposite of McEwan's, who, when I asked him about implausibility in the otherwise wonderful On Chesil Beach, told me he wrote about the one in a million chance of something extraordinary happening to people. Swift, by contrast, writes about the ordinary. This is not to say that the events that befall his protagonists are trite. They are not. But they are the stuff of quotidian life. Bereavement, ageing, and PTSD in a former soldier. The wars of the title are sometimes momentous, the Second World War, but others are private battles, such as the trauma of losing a parent, spouse, or grandchild. Swift focuses his lens so that in each vignette we have a close-up of everything in that microcosm, including inside the protagonist's head. Post-war, an officer who fought for the Nazis meets a young Jewish soldier seeking help in tracking down relatives who may have survived the Holocaust. A frail elderly woman longs to lose her mind so as to reduce her awareness of her infirmity. There are no twists, and a protagonist sometimes analyzes semantics in a way that only language aficionados do. I prefer Swift's novels, where we have a longer journey with the intricately drawn characters. But these stories are very powerful and poignant snapshots.
And that's everything for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate, review, and follow however you subscribe to your podcasts. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.